VA nominee Dr. Ronnie Jackson under fire. What does it all say about the president's management style? Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with analysis from political scientists Jim McCormick and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. We'll also ask them about waning support among Republicans for EPA head Scott Pruitt. Also, yesterday's court ruling that says Trump can't end DACA, the state visit by French President Emmanuel Macron and what's being called Le Bromance, and the proposed new deal on the Iran nuclear accord, and lots more. Lots of wood to chop this hour. First, this news. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Paired up in our Ames studio, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Also of Iowa State University, Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science. Dave and Jim, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We have a full hour ahead of us. Later in the hour, I'll ask Dave and Jim to comment on that court ruling that says President Trump can't end DACA. Of course, the state visit by the French President Emmanuel Macron and what's being called Le Bromance. Also, that Iran nuclear accord. We heard about that in the news with Emmanuel Macron speaking just a few minutes ago before Congress. A few other things. Scott Pruitt is also on our agenda. But let's start off with the confirmation hearing that was supposed to happen today for Dr. Ronnie Jackson. Donald Trump standing behind Jackson, the White House physician, as his pick to lead the Veterans Affairs Department. Instead of that hearing, it's been postponed indefinitely to give the Senate some time to investigate numerous accusations against Dr. Jackson, namely that he oversaw a hostile work environment. He improperly dispensed prescription medication and possibly drank on the job. Speaking in front of reporters yesterday, President Trump said he likes Ronnie Jackson and that he is qualified, but that Jackson should make the decision whether to move forward.
And this person, Admiral Jackson, Dr. Jackson, is a wonderful man. I said to him, what do you need it for? And as far as experience is concerned, the Veterans Administration, which is approximately 13 million people, is so big, you could run the biggest hospital system in the world, and it's small time compared to the Veterans Administration. So nobody has the experience. What he is a leader and a good man. But I told him, I said, you know what, Doc? You're too fine a person. His son's a top student at Annapolis. He's a high-quality person. I said, what do you need it for? So he'll be it's totally his decision, but he'll be making a decision.
Jim McCormick, what do you make of the status of Ronnie Jackson as the nominee and the president's leaving it to Jackson to make the decision?
Well, it does really raise the question about how much sort of vetting there was done on it. And, you know, usually the White House is going to have sort of their legislative people talk to the members of Congress about a nominee and see if they have any questions that are raised. And I'm not sure that this was done. At least it wasn't done very effectively if there were really these stories about of his, you know, sort of background and action and inaction that was taken. I mean, I guess the other side of it is that what has also come out is, I think probably our listeners are aware of, is that both President Obama and President Trump have been very, very laudatory about Dr. Jackson's activities within the White House. So we'll really see these kind of a contrast in terms of the views of different people here.
And this picture of Dr. Jackson, also under previous presidents, walking down the aisles of planes that were, you know, admittedly going to be under flying for 10, 14 hours, just dispensing prescription drugs to also the press corps.
Wow.
no examination required. Here's your pills to go to sleep. Here are your pills to wake up. Dave, your view, I mean, which of these allegations, Dave, do you see as most troubling?
Well, honestly, the thing that I see is most troubling is just the nature of how the nomination came about. Usually, if you're going to nominate somebody for a cabinet-level position, there's a set of procedures you follow. You draw up a short list of the most qualified people you can find in the country. You then vet them to make sure that there's no skeletons in the closet and that they're appropriate and they could survive nomination battles. And then you interview with the president to see if you are going to get along and there's a good fit. And with Ronny Jackson, it doesn't pass the sniff test. The VA is the second largest agency in government. It's the second largest bureaucracy. And Ronny Jackson has never managed a staff of more than 70 people. It's kind of like nominating your local police chief to run the Department of Defense. There's nothing wrong with being a local police chief. It's an honorable position. You can be very good at it. But if you haven't done a relevant job, you really just don't have the qualifications.
Well, with the president, we just heard him say, you know, nobody's really qualified. This thing is so huge. But it doesn't sound like you believe that, right? I mean,
the
previous administrator did. And
he's absolutely accurate in the term that there is no parallel job. But usually you try to approximate it. You find somebody who has managed a large organization. You find somebody who has administrative experience in managing a very large operation. So you have the experience of something similar. Ronny Jackson may be a fantastic doctor, and all indications, I think, are that he is a very qualified doctor. But it doesn't seem like he has the necessary bureaucratic experience to run an agency. And then when so far, I think they're kind of like mini scandals come out. It really makes you question whether they really vet his background at all.
Right. And we've got allegations, 20, I think, members of the military coming forward to say that he was abusive to staff. We have, now, these are not allegations that have been proven, but as White House physician, that he was apparently needed to be roused to tend to the president, a previous president, I assume, and could not be roused because of drinking. Allegations at this point.
But allegations you generally don't want to be aired before Congress in a hearing. Usually if allegations like this surface about a nominee, the committee who is determining that this person could be a nominee will say, you know what, we can probably find somebody with fewer skeletons in the closet.
Right. And if these allegations are true, wouldn't you say, Dave, this would also, if all of them are true, would disqualify him as White House physician if you can't depend 24/7 on the physician being there for the health of our president?
One would think so.
Mm-hmm. Jim, let me ask you about this. Tell me if you see this pattern emerging. It seems we have a president, no secret, he is not easily controlled by his advisors, by his staff. We have a lot of leaks, so we have also in this case staff resorting to leaks to rein him in. So Dr. Ronny Jackson put forward against the advice of some of the president's advisors, and so these sorts of allegations are leaked to the press, and we have what we have.
Now, this is a control mechanism, isn't it, by the staff? Instead of going directly to the president and telling him bad news, it's to do this indirect method of trying to control his behavior. I think what we have here, though, sort of if I could just add a little bit what Dave was saying here, is the president is really determined. I mean, he loves a fight. And I think he's going to put himself in a position here that even if some of this dirty laundry is going to be publicly displayed in the halls of Congress, in the halls of the Senate here, I think the president, you know, just loves to sort of mix it up. And we saw that with the Pompeo nomination as well. So I think that even with the leaks, this president is probably be hard-pressed to be dissuaded, and it actually may take congressional action, or in this case, Senate action, to change behavior.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Dave Anderson of Politics Wednesday, join our discussion. Number of points we're going through, the top half dozen developments on the political landscape, all of them the national landscape this week, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about Scott Pruitt. There's always so much news on a national level that we have not talked a lot about Scott Pruitt, but maybe be a turning point for the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt. He seems to be losing support even from his staunchest allies, his longtime political patron, Senator James Inhofe. Inhofe from Oklahoma as well, yesterday said he would like to see an investigation into the ethical allegations against Pruitt. If any proved true, Inhofe said, he could, in his words, have it could they could have an effect. It seems that the senator there is troubled by a recent New York Times story detailing allegations of unchecked spending, ethics questions during Mr. Pruitt's career as attorney general, state senator in Oklahoma. What do we have in the news, gentlemen? We have his illegal purchase of an office phone booth. What was that, $43,000? A soundproof phone booth, his expenditures on first-class travel, that rental of a condominium linked to an energy a lobbyist. Dave, your thoughts. How big a trouble is sort of piling up for Scott Pruitt?
Enough trouble that any prior office holder probably would have been forced out of the position already. The allegations are not only serious, but they're numerous. They just keep rolling out. It seems like every week we find out that Scott Pruitt did something else that is ethically questionable, if not illegal. And I think he's held on to his position so far because he's been very loyal to the president, and he is enacting the changes at the EPA that the president wants. So President Trump and I think a lot of Republicans in Congress are sticking with him, but it's getting to the point where I think even them are, they're starting to question, can't we find somebody with less baggage to do this?
Mm-hmm. And as you said, doing the work that the president wants done in his environmental agenda, undoing EPA climate change rules, pulling out of the U.S., the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. And then also yesterday, the EPA announcing that a new regulation would restrict the kind of scientific studies. Listen to this. The kind of scientific studies the agency can use when it develops policies. Now, critics are saying it will permanently weaken the agency's ability to protect public health. Under this new measure from the EPA, put out by Scott Pruitt, required that the underlying data for all scientific studies used by the agency to formulate air and water regulations be publicly available. And critics say that's going to sharply limit the number of studies available for consideration because much of the research relies on confidential health data from study subjects. Well, let's listen to Scott Pruitt talking about this new rule. He says it will be a rule that lasts a long time. He says it makes the science transparent and reproducible.
When we use third parties, it's really remarkable to me. When you go use a third party and you publish only their findings, but not the methodology and data, how is that enhanced transparency under the APA? How does that actually inform citizens across the country in the proper way with respect to rulemaking? So this is the right approach, and it's right not only in fixing this going forward on the policy side of things, but it's going to be codified through rulemaking, which will mean it's durable. And I think that will be very, very helpful to the American people.
Okay. So, Jim, how do you weigh in on this? One side, the EPA under Scott Pruitt says this strengthens the role of science. Critics like, let's say, Gina McCarthy, the former EPA administrator, says the rule could undermine the rules intended to protect public health because the studies used to support those rules rely on private health data.
Well, usually under the scientific method, actually you do want to have data publicly available for everybody to observe. I guess the question comes here, and you sort of raised it, is if there's confidential information, if people have been provided confidentiality in sharing some of this information, then we have a sort of a different ball game here, and we wouldn't want to see that violation. Certainly even in university campuses, you know, we have this human subjects review that we have to go through, particularly if there's any kind of human subject data being involved. So I think that's where the clash really comes, it seems to me, in terms of the openness that you would expect under the scientific method. I thought one of the things that is interesting that might be added here, it was interesting on Sunday in one of the talk programs Mark Short was on, who's a legislative official in the Trump administration, and he gave this ringing endorsement to Pruitt. And he said that the president still has great confidence in him. And as you sort of outlined here, Pruitt has been very systematic in fulfilling the president's agenda in terms of the Clean Power Plan and as the Paris Agreement, and more recently in terms of the fuel economy standard as well. So I think it's going to be very difficult, even as these things kind of roll up, because Pruitt still has the confidence, it seems to me, of one individual, and that may be the crucial determinant factor here.
Mm-hmm. Dave, your opinion, but I want to quote a little bit more of the former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy and her criticism of this new rule. She writes in a New York Times op-ed article, don't be fooled by this talk of transparency, and some members of Congress are setting up a non-existent problem in order to prevent the EPA from using the best available science. Weigh in on this, Dave.
Yeah, well, I think this is really part of a larger pattern. With the Trump administration, what they want to do is make the EPA more friendly to large businesses, which, as a side effect of producing stuff, create a lot of pollution. And the EPA was created to monitor the levels of pollution being created and determine when it was causing negative public health effects. Well, the only way you can do that is to use public health records, which are almost always confidential because people don't want their medical information freely available to other people to read.
Confidential in that the name is removed and the data is let to go on. So if they want data on my health, my name is separated from it, so I preserve my confidentiality.
It is. However, you have to give your release to have your medical information used in a study. And most people don't draw the distinction between, so you're going to take my name off, okay, I will let you use my data. And usually you have to assure people that there is no way that you can ever be identified through your data. And with this, that kind of gets taken away. So while the way they're talking about this, the data would still be kept confidential, most members of the public don't make that distinction. And we know through lots of history and medical research that if you can't promise people that they will never be identified, they won't give you access to their data. So what this means is we are going to be very limited in the amount of research that can be conducted on public health matters. It's true to say it makes the data more transparent because everybody will be able to use the data that is used now. But a side effect is there will be less data available to base research studies on. And this is an intentional thing. The EPA right now is trying to help industries to make a profit better. And one of the ways to do that is to limit the number of regulations we have trying to create clean air and clean water. And this is one way about it.
Dave Anderson, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Politics Wednesday here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. We have 5 minutes or so before our break. Let's get on to the Macron state visit, the visit by the French president. They may have their disagreements, but it seems the two get along quite well. Looking to remarks or descriptions from the New York Times, listen to this. This is the New York Times covering the second day. When President Trump welcomed President Emmanuel Macron of France to the White House on Tuesday for the first state official visit of the Trump administration, their body language went beyond the usual respectful handshakes of two world leaders meeting for high-level talks and bordered on the intimate. There was a mutual kiss on the cheek in the East Room, where Mr. Macron clasped hands with Mr. Trump, pulling him in for an embrace and a brief peck as Mr. Trump puckered his lips slightly to reciprocate. "I like him a lot," Mr. Trump explained to reporters and officials looking on. Earlier in the Oval Office, the president had gently brushed what he said was dandruff off of Mr. Macron's shoulder. "We have to make him perfect," Mr. Trump said of Mr. Macron, 40 years old. "He is perfect." Moments later, they sat side by side. Mr. Macron placed his hand on Mr. Trump's knee. Let's listen to that dandruff comment. He caught on camera, of course. It was a photo op. Trump speaking in front of reporters with Macron had a moment when he appeared to pick something off Macron's shoulder.
"It's a great honor that you're here, but we do have a very special relationship. In fact, I'll get that little piece of dandruff off. A little piece. We have to make him perfect. He is perfect. So it is really great to be with you, and you are a special friend. Thank you."
"It's great to be with you, but you have dandruff." Jim, What do you say to that?
Well, he doesn't have dandruff now. he's been excised of his dandruff. I mean, it really is quite a remarkable kind of exchange that they had. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, we've not seen that with other state visits. There's usually the sort of the formality of a handshake and pleasantries, but not this kind of rushing up to each other and the kind of closeness that you've described and that the New York Times outlined here. I guess it goes back to, I was thinking about this morning, you know, France, of course, is America's first ally. The first treaty the United States ever had with was yes. France in 1778. It was obviously instrumental in our independence. So maybe this is a rebirth of this kind of close tie, because of course over the decades there has been tension with France, in terms of France at one juncture pulling out of the military aspect of NATO, and Charles de Gaulle going his own way, and then even subsequent presidents have often challenged the American president, and so I guess this is some closure in this. Otherwise. If you look, and we'll probably get to the speech that the French president gave to Congress, he actually spoke about things that are diametrically opposed to what President Trump has articulated here. So I'm not sure that this friendship is more than of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Dave, comment on this. What is being termed libromance here? is it all just photo op stuff? But actually, they differ quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, I think it's actually a really great window into how President Trump is altering the office of the president, the institution of the presidency. That we would never have seen a prior president act like this with another world leader, because prior presidents really felt that they were assuming kind of a symbolic role as the face of the nation. They were assuming the office of the presidency, and they were acting on behalf of the nation, and a formal state dinner or visit was a time for the two nations to come together, and the two nations came together through their leaders. But that's not how Trump views the presidency. The presidency is not about the institution. It's largely not about the country. It is about him and what he wants to do. And this was, the entire visit was very much about a personal interaction between two heads of state. Mm-hmm. And it was collegial, it was fun, it was playful, and it was unlike anything we have ever seen before.
Mm-hmm. Jim,
I wonder if we'll have a joint communique come out of that. I haven't seen this. It would be interesting to see what that joint communique says. And to the extent that they emphasize the personality and the personal relationship yeah. versus the substance of the relationship. I haven't seen a communique, but usually after these kind of state visits, there is, a formal statement, each of the presidents or dignitaries thanking one another and then talking about the areas they agree with. And it'll be very interesting to see if that is manifest here.
So you're saying if it's more just the personality, the chemistry between the two brought out, then the policy meeting of the minds wasn't there.
That's right. I mean, I think it's pretty evident from what the French president said at to the Congress that there's still differences, even if they try to sort of wallpaper it over.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. More from Jim McCormick and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, our two political scientists, picking apart many things on the landscape in the last few days. When we come back, this ties into the Macron visit. We'll also talk about the Iranian deal. Macron says he's against withdrawal from that nuclear deal in his speech before Congress, but somehow they're working on a new deal that would expand and extend the terms of that accord. One of the things we'll talk about when we come out, also that ruling on DACA yesterday by a federal judge. Dave Anderson, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join the conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for being with us. Jim McCormick is with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at ISU. I'm glad you could join us. Still to come, we'll talk about DACA, a federal judge ruling on that yesterday. We hope to get to the Comey memos, the DNC lawsuit as well, but You know, that's 4 or 5 days old, almost ancient, in the accelerated news cycle that we live in. Let's talk about Iran and then North Korea. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, and our president, Donald Trump, announced they're working on a new deal that would expand and extend the terms of the 2015 accord between Iran, not just between Iran and the U.S., but five other nations, France, the U.K., Germany, China, and Russia. Let me play a little bit of the president commenting on this and then get to Jim's thoughts. While Macron was in Washington, President Trump answered questions from the press, including about the possible consequences if we pull out of the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iranians say they'll restart their nuclear program if the deal
We'll find out. You'll find out about that.
Are you concerned
won't
about
be
that?
So easy for them to restart.
Mr. President, are you...
They're not going to be restarting anything. They restart it, they're going to have big problems, bigger than they've ever had before. And you can mark it down. They restart their nuclear program, they will have bigger problems than they have ever had before. Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay, Jim, I'm a little confused here. We're talking about a new deal that would expand and extend, but at the same time, Macron before Congress says he's against withdrawing from any from the current nuclear deal. What do you see going on?
Well, apparently Macron has been discussing with the European allies, the European members of this agreement here, in which he would try to get, first of all, you know, one of the concerns of the Trump administration is there's a sunset clause in the Iran agreement. Basically, after 8 years, things start to change, and even up to 15 years, of course, you know, they can actually accelerate their centrifuges here. So that's one element. The other element that the Trump administration is concerned about is the ballistic missile testing that Iran has actually been doing. And the Trump administration has said that's a violation of the agreement. Technically, it's really not, because the UN resolution that endorsed the Iran agreement said that they would call upon Iran not to engage in ballistic missile testing, but it did not require that they not engage in this kind of testing. And, of course, the third element that's also part of Macron's effort here is with regard to Iran's activity, particularly in the larger Middle East here, in terms of supporting some groups that are threatening such governments as Yemen and Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and so on. And so this is the kind of deal that they're trying to work out in terms of getting these allies to accept it. But, you know, already apparently the Iranians have said, No dice. I mean, there's been an interview on a CBS interview with the foreign minister of Iran in which he said that any kind of change in the agreement, you know, would that the Iranians would start up in terms of their right. production of centrifuges.
And then the Iranian president, Rouhani,
sure.
also just questioning the legitimacy of President Trump doing that. You don't have any background in politics, he said.
That's right.
On that show. You don't have any background in law. You don't have any background on international treaties. So he's making that argument.
He's throwing a lot of cold water on it, it seems mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure that even the European allies will want to do this. Because, see, the other element here is, of course, that the Europeans have gained a fair bit by removing these sanctions in terms of trade with Iran. And
big business opportunities.
Big business opportunities. And are they going to be willing to slap sanctions back on? Mm-hmm. Even if the Americans do that, even if the president on May the 12th said he's not going to sign any more waivers of sanctions here, I'm not sure the Europeans will follow. And the Iranians might have it the best of both worlds. They have the removal of these sanctions by the Europeans, which have been their principal economic partners here. And they also have this kind of division in the Western alliance. Mm-hmm. So it may not be such a smart move just on May the 12th to not sign on to waiving those sanctions.
The United States' other nuclear worry in the world, of course, North Korea. Yesterday, Donald Trump said the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been, in his words, very honorable. This is the man he called Little Rocket Man. And discussions on a planned summit were going well, says the president. He tempered the expectations for any quick denuclearization by saying it may all be we're all wasting a lot of time. Jim, in briefly, how do you see that developing, that summit, either what, May or June?
As I've said a couple times, I'm very skeptical of an agreement that can really be struck with the North Koreans. We've sort of seen this picture before in terms of, you know, they sort of make a kind of a peace offensive, if you will, and then once things start to happen in terms of particular economic benefits that flow to North Korea, they back off. Obviously, President Trump believes that there's more sincerity listed here, but I'm very, very skeptical. And it'll be very interesting to see where these talks, if they eventuate, where they will be held. They be held in Asia? Will the American president have to travel to Asia to meet with the North Korean leader? Or will the North Korean leader actually go all the way to Europe? I think that probably the North Koreans are going to make the demand that President Trump travel to, say, Singapore. The other place has been Mongolia, but which I find
the North Korean,
difficult to believe that they'd have the summit meeting in Mongolia. But
since being in power, the North Korean leader has been out of his country once, and
that's
that was
right.
To China, right? On that train.
On a train, yeah. And so he's going to have to use air transport, it seems to me. Maybe ships, I don't know, but at least air transport here. But I think it's going to be that he's going to demand that the American president fly to Asia. Again, getting more kind of deference than he's already gotten in terms of even having a meeting with the American president.
Dave, let me bat the latest news about DACA out to your field to have you handle it. A federal judge yesterday ruling that the Trump administration's decision to end deportation protections for some young immigrants, he said that is not in his decision. He said that this is the district judge, John D. Bates, for the District of Columbia, said the White House was, in his words, arbitrary and capricious in moving to end this DACA program from Obama's era. He said the Department of Homeland Security failed to provide an adequate rationale for why the program is unlawful. Where does this leave DACA? This affects some, 700 young immigrants. These are the people among us, young immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children.
700,000 young immigrants.
Did I not say that? I misspoke. 700. I said 700. Oh, shoot. 700.
Yeah, it's a little bit more important than just 700.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. There were three zeros. I just missed that.
This kind of continues DACA being up in the air. By all accounts, the president should have a lot of leeway on whether he wants to continue the DACA program. And I think what the court is really signaling here is all the president has to do is give a valid reason why he is going to end it, and it can be ended. But what the Trump administration simply did was they labeled it unlawful and said they were going to, without ever explaining why it would be unlawful. It does not contradict with any law of Congress. Congress left great latitude for the president to determine how he is going to prioritize deportations. When Obama enacted DACA, he gave a very clear set of guidelines on why he was going to deprioritize the deportation of children who were brought here. And I think the Trump administration simply has to come up with a rationale now. But it means we're going to continue to talk about DACA for a long time until Congress finally intervenes and clarifies the situation.
All right. 90 days for Homeland Security to better explain its view, according to this ruling. That DACA is illegal, something to continue to watch. Related to this, we heard in the top of the hour news the Trump administration's travel ban reaching the Supreme Court, and what we're hearing in the arguments today, actually, Mara Elias and or Nina Totenberg, rather, that the court perhaps is leaning toward upholding this third 3.0 version of the travel ban. Justice Kennedy evidently not wanting to second guess the national security decisions of President Trump. Jim, tell us about this. This is the banning travelers from six mainly Muslim countries. We had the last version add North Korea, also Venezuela.
Yes, I guess a couple of them have been dropped from this. I think there were originally eight countries that were under this proposed ban here, or trying to get this ban enacted here. I think again, as you pointed out, the presidents and have had lots of discretion on kind of national security. And I mean, it was interesting that apparently Justice Kennedy raised the issue that they didn't really want to get into the thicket of how much national security information the executive branch might have with regard to of who's coming into the country from these particular countries. So I think that probably is going to sway Kennedy to allow the president to go forward with this. At least, again, a very split decision is likely to be the outcome here. On national security issues, as has been the case in the past, the president gets a lot of latitude, and this, I think, is just one further evidence of this. I was interested to note that in the discussion, I thought the plaintiffs were going to bring up the argument here that, in fact, the president had said all of these kind of derogatory comments during the campaign against mm-hmm. Muslim countries and so on. But that does not seem to have been particularly persuasive in the discussion. And again, it would get the Supreme Court justices into a sort of a political realm rather than simply into trying to decipher the law here.
Mm-hmm. Comment, Dave, on what happened in Arizona yesterday, the Republicans defending a seat in Arizona yesterday. They avoided another special election. Upset. It was tight in the single digits, I think. But it was a very strong GOP district that went to Donald Trump by 21 points. The Republican defeating the Democrat by only about 5%, I think, if I'm reading correctly here. So reaction to that, any kind of bellwether for November as we're watching these special elections in the run-up to November?
Absolutely. I think yesterday's election gives both parties something to brag about. The Republican Party held on to the seat, which is a good indication for them in the state of Arizona. But if you look deeper into the numbers, the Democratic Party is thrilled by this result. This district is about 25 points more Republican than your average district in America.
And we say that because of
prior elections.
And voter registration, too, right?
Actually, this is just looking at how the district tends to vote. Mm-hmm. So in the prior elections, both Mitt Romney and President Trump carried this district by 21 points. So this should be a very safe Republican pickup. In a special election, you might expect it to be very low turnout, which usually also benefits Republican candidates. And the Democratic Party came within single digits of winning this, which continues a trend we've been seeing for almost 2 years now of Democrats doing much, much better than they are expected to. We've seen it in Pennsylvania. We saw it in Alabama. Now we see it in Arizona. And this is, frankly, raising, red flags all across the nation for the Republican Party of the November elections are going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk. We haven't talked about this hour, the myriad of challenges facing Donald Trump. Since we last had you on, each of you, let's just recount those quickly. The recent FBI raid of the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, last week's release of James Comey's memos, the former FBI director, the fired former FBI director, his memos recounting the sort of bizarre interactions he had with the president, the release of Comey's book, the instant New York Times bestseller, and that just announced Democratic National Committee, the DNC's lawsuit, alleging a conspiracy between the Trump campaign, Russia, and WikiLeaks. To this point, that DNC lawsuit, it doesn't name Trump, but it includes Trump confidant Roger Stone, also Jared Kushner, Donald Trump Jr., WikiLeaks, and someone called Guccifer 2.0. That's the hacker who claimed credit for the DNC breach that released those DNC emails through WikiLeaks. But, Jim, is this, I've seen criticism, a distraction from the Mueller probe? Wise for the DNC to do this?
Well, what I think what it does is, of course, keep alive the whole investigation of the administration. I'm not sure that it's going to lead very far. I mean, there's been all kinds of criticism jumped on this lawsuit that it does not make any mention of the dossier that was used in terms of getting the FISA warrant. And so on, and which also fits into this picture you listed of all of the WikiLeaks and these others, but there's no mention, and that will be obviously brought up by those challenging this lawsuit. So I think what it basically does is to keep the issue alive rather than to lead to any kind of resolution.
Mm-hmm. Dave, how about this criticism from another Dave, David Axelrod, the former advisor to President Obama, calling the DNC suit a sideshow that seems, in his words, spectacularly ill-timed and helpful only to President Trump's strategy of portraying a sober and essential probe as a partisan vendetta, in the words of David Axelrod. Well, how do you see that, Dave?
I think Axelrod has some good points there. I think it really depends on whether you see this probe as really being a criminal investigation or something that the party is hoping to benefit from politically. And Axelrod is making the case that we need to see what the results of the investigation are. I think the DNC is looking at this as an attempt to win the next election, and they want to keep this story alive. They want to keep it in the news. I think the DNC also has a strong incentive to keep bringing up the parallels between this investigation and the Watergate scandal under Richard Nixon. And one of the things that happened under the Watergate scandal was the DNC sued Nixon and the campaign for a whole bunch of different reasons. And this lawsuit makes today look a lot like Watergate. And nobody in the Republican Party wants this investigation to remind people of Watergate.
Mm-hmm. What are the both of your view on the parallels? I mean, this one you just named, Dave, others there, certainly similarities, dissimilarities.
Well, the clearest one, I think, is that what really tipped the scales of the Watergate investigation is the Saturday Night Massacre, where Richard Nixon fired the attorney general, the deputy attorney general, and had to go through a chain of command until he finally found somebody who was willing to fire the special investigation. And that was the point where the Watergate scandal kind of tipped over and the public said, okay, you're probably guilty.
Mm-hmm. Where there's dissimilarity, it seems to me, is one of the things about the Watergate was that there were these public hearings that aired day after day after day that put a lot of factual information right on the record here. And, you know, there's just been the term here is there's been a cacophony of voices here with regard to what's going on with this Mueller investigation, mm-hmm. and what's going on with regard to the Cohen investigation, and trying to sort out, you know, fact from fiction, unlike during the Watergate when it was really clear as they built their case and even on both sides of the aisle during those hearings. And we don't have that right now. I suspect lots of the American public have really tuned out on this because, you know, it's hard to sort out fact from fiction, as I said.
Right. And another key difference between these days and the early 70s during the Watergate era, isn't it? The media environment, we have all these news silos. Unlike then, three networks, one educational channel on TV, we had three networks very close in their sort of editorial view of what is news and how you report news. We do not have that anymore.
Terrific point. It's really a terrific point because what you have is now every day, you know, you have one cable news network coming out analyzing the latest information released from one angle and the other from the other angle. And again, this only adds, it seems to me, to the public confusion. So the media has become much more the actor.
Right. And you can stay on your particular media island, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. You can believe whatever you want to believe and find a station that will back up your point of view.
And maybe some information that will support it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
We have a minute or so. The Comey memos got scant mention. They're finally released. Any highlights that jump out Dave, that we hadn't known before? I mean, we knew a lot of this, right?
We knew most of this. I think what this really turned into was I feel like this is a attempt by Republicans in Congress to provide cover for the president by talking about the Comey memos and alleging that there's something in there that would exonerate the president, hoping that the Comey memos would never actually be released. We saw this earlier with the drafted statement by Devin Nunes's team alleging that the Mueller investigation had breached all kinds of standards in running their investigation. And then that memo was leaked and the Democrats' response was leaked. And it turned out to be a large nothing burger. And this one, I think, largely goes the same way, that it was better as a talking point. But when the memos come out, it actually strengthens Mueller's position, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last I saw, 600,000 copies of Comey's book sold. That was a couple days ago.
Wow.
Dave and Jim, is that required reading on your own reading list?
I don't list it as required reading. I think we can all assume that we know what is in there.
Okay.
Yep, I think that's the case.
Okay, very good. Jim and Dave, thanks for stepping into our studio today. We love to get your insights and analysis. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank
you.
Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State. And our program is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Natalia Reyes helping out today as well. And help in Ames from, I think, Jason Burns, perhaps Sean McClain. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.